The 2023 baseball season is over, and the Texas Rangers have won their first ever franchise championship. So we'll talk about that and the rest of the World Series on this final season episode of The Bandwagon. This is The Bandwagon, a podcast about baseball and trying to figure out what it is that still smells like beer. I think it might be my scrunchie. I'm Hannah Kaiser, a baseball writer at Yahoo Sports, joined by Zach Kreiser, also a baseball writer at Yahoo Sports. Hello, do you still smell of booze?
No, I no longer smell of booze.
I think it's my scrunchie and my phone, which is definitely
your
not
phone.
Good.
Ooh.
Yeah, and the night I would pick up my phone to do something and I would be like, oh, something smells.
So it is 9 a.m. Phoenix time on Thursday, which means less than 12 hours ago, we were in the Rangers clubhouse celebration after they won the franchise's first World Series. If you are getting that news from us, I don't know why you listen to a baseball podcast, but welcome to the bandwagon. We are through the season.
We did it. I really hate when people lead with the talking about the like champagne celebration, which I refuse to call a champagne celebration. I just say
it's beer.
It's primarily beer. I saw 90% beer. And then we went back out on the field and someone, I don't know, doing like a local TV hit was like, is this the craziest celebration you've seen? And I was like, not even close. The Phillies participated in this postseason and last year almost made it to the end. But it was good. It was they were celebrating. They were happy. This is not the most pressing question on anybody's mind. But how do you feel about lumping in the Washington Senators when we talk about how long it's been that the Texas Rangers franchise hasn't won a World Series?
I don't lump in the Senators. We can just say that it's the Rangers' first World Series title, which is plenty. Like,
yes,
there are people who have been following this team since day one or since day one of their life, and they have never seen a World Series. We don't need to additionally add some teams from Washington. They have their own team now. It's not like
they have their own team now, and it's presumably a different fan base. The Texas portion of the Texas Rangers' existence is definitely long enough for it to lots of people's lifespans have not featured a Texas Rangers championship until yesterday.
They specifically had the heartbreak of 2011 with David Freese hitting all those homers for the Cardinals. I think this World Series run honestly did a pretty good job exercising that particular demon, if it could be exercised.
So. Yeah, a lot of specific and flattering to the Rangers parallels going on this year. We did not talk at any point during the World Series, but I also don't know that we need to like recap every game of the World Series. We had a podcast at some point along the way in which we talked about how this was a bad postseason, and then the CSs happened, and those were phenomenal. I think it really peaked with the CSs postseason. What will you remember about this postseason as a whole? Do you think it will be the World Series, or will it be an earlier round game team that already got eliminated?
I think there are three main things I will remember from this World Series. One is...
No, postseason.
Sorry. From the postseason, which is actually what I meant. I think there are three main things I will remember from this postseason. Two of them did happen in the CS. I think the combo of the Adolis Garcia beaning, the fight, the Astros winning, and then the Rangers coming back to actually take over the series after that is probably the... Given that the Rangers won the World Series, I think that will wind up being the most memorable thing. The second thing I think will be the Diamondbacks in general, just defeating bigger team after bigger team after supposedly better team after supposedly better team all the way up until they ran into the Rangers. And the third thing I think will be that game one in the World Series where the Rangers kind of...
What happened in game one? I don't remember.
Corey Seager hit a game-tying home run in the ninth, and then Adolis Garcia walked it off in the 11th.
Wow, that was so good.
I think that will be the defining moment of this World Series. That was a game on the road that the Diamondbacks looked like they controlled, especially when you combine that with the knowledge that they would also control and win game two. It really felt like that game one win was the Rangers asserting themselves that, hey, even if you play your best game, we have these guys that will just homer and we will win. And so I think those are the three biggest highlights that I will recall.
Yes, I distinctly remember now thinking, I wish that was the end of the World Series, because that was a really dramatic but also characteristic way for the Rangers to win a World Series or to win a game or postseason series. Game one was really good. And then game five, it ended in five games, by the way. Did we say that? It ended in five games. Game five was really good. And then the final score didn't quite reflect that. And it was very good in a very different way, which was that, like, Zach Gallen was no hitting the Rangers through six. And Nathan Eovaldi could not get through an inning without giving up a base runner. And yet somehow the game was still tied. Nothing. And then one run scored. Corey Seager got a hit to break up the no-hitter, and then he scored. And I kind of wanted it to end 1-0 just for that level of, like, that level of both reflecting how close the game felt and also for being so contrary to how the Rangers won most of their games, which was not, like, scratching one run across and then turning it over to the bullpen.
That was a very Diamondbacks way to win games.
Yes. Instead, they tacked on four more runs, which was nice because Marcus Semien got to hit a home run, and that's good for him because he had a rough postseason up until the World Series. I think you're right. I think my enduring memory of this postseason as a whole will probably be Adolis Garcia. And even the Adolis Garcia gets hurt and misses the last two games and the Rangers still win. Like, I think that the postseason makes the most sense in some ways, like, just seen through the lens of, like, he was kind of an under the radar, but really toolsy guy who really went off in October at the right time. Seems like they couldn't get him out in the same way it felt like. I mean, the Rangers never lost on the road. I was talking to somebody yesterday about how this game five was going to go. And I was like, I feel like it's going to end. I feel like it's going to end today, which would mean that the Rangers would win. And they were like, yeah. I was like, because the Diamondbacks aren't that good of a team. The person I was talking to was like, well, the Rangers aren't that good of a team. And I was like, false. The Rangers are either a very good team or a very bad team, depending what week you catch them. They're rarely mediocre. And they were really good this whole postseason, kind of in the Adolis Garcia, like, they were like a player who gets hot at the right time, kind of. They were a whole collection of players who got hot at the right time. And that, like, they seemed team of destiny type energy. I will also probably remember the Phillies, to be honest. I really think in the end, sorry, Diamondbacks, the Phillies and the Rangers felt like the representative teams, if not the actual teams representing those two leagues. But maybe that's because we got a Rangers championship. And I think this is what a lot of people will be talking about today. Because we got a Rangers championship, it then reflects back on the rest of the season to make it look like, oh, maybe those Mets, Yankees, Padres teams that spent a lot of money and didn't do well just spent that money poorly, because, like, it felt like, oh, it's going to be the Phillies and Rangers in the World Series, and then we're going to have this kind of reckoning with teams that had homegrown players but spent on stars. And we only kind of got that. But then we got that validation because the Rangers won.
Right. I think there's going to be a lot of confused discussion about payrolls, especially as we head into an offseason with a pretty famous dude named Shohei Ohtani available for signing on the free agent market. There's this sense that, well, you know, putting a lot of money into your team on free agents, it sets you up for collapse because they're older and maybe they will take a downturn. And, you know, Max Scherzer lived out both sides of this coin by going from the Mets to the Rangers midseason. And I think the thing that people have to keep in mind with that is literally last year, the Rangers, who had just spent $500 million, were bad, were out and out bad. And then this year, they flipped it around and won the World Series. And if you don't think that's possible for the Mets or the Yankees or
the
Padres, you are not paying attention. It right. could totally happen.
Yes.
That's what money buys you.
That's what we've been saying with the Padres all along, is that, like, I don't know, man, I would not bet on them next year. Although now it seems like they might need to shed some payroll since they just took out a loan. I think we have not been paying a ton of attention to the growing, the burbling?
Burbling.
That word sounds so wrong. burbling? Is that really what it is?
I don't know what you're about to say. So
the burbling off-season news. That's what I was going to say. But how, like, I've seen headlines about Juan Soto potentially being traded, and I have clicked on none of them because I have been busy. And I assume you have clicked on none of them either. But
Today is officially the start of MLBTradeRumors.com season. Yeah.
So now I will catch up on where has Craig Counsell interviewed, not interviewed. I did see a lot of, like, he has not yet interviewed in New York tweets. And I was like, I don't know that that necessitates a tweet. But as of today, I think he's in New York. I think he's going to interview. So,
well, it's funny to me that's like, oh, he hasn't interviewed. It's like, he knows the dude who runs the team. I'm pretty sure they are, you know. It's not going to be, like, the most pressing interview.
It was like, when they, you know, like those websites they make that's like, has X happened yet? Like, they just needed like a, has Craig Counsell interviewed with the Mets? Like, I was like, I don't need to tweet every day that he hasn't done it. I just tell me when I'll assume he hasn't until he has. And I also, now we're just talking about my takes on off-season news. I'm like, will he be there on April 1st? That's all I really care. Like, we have so many days between now and then in which I don't need to know if he has not yet accepted the job.
We're going to get like a full-on, you know, Craig Counsell real estate watch where are tracking his plane movements and his house listings. And
his plane movements? You think Craig Counsell takes private planes?
You know, I don't know. Probably not.
That would be so un-Midwestern of him.
But I would not be shocked if Steve Cohen, Mets owner, sent private planes for anyone who comes to interview with the Mets. That seems very possible.
Touche. Okay, we should get back to talking about the Rangers.
The World Series.
And the T-Bakes. Yeah. Is there anything, any kind of, so unofficially I covered the Rangers and you covered the Diamondbacks. So before we, like, I don't know, dig in more on what the Rangers did well and who was good, you said you ran out of thoughts about the Diamondbacks. So I'm kind of teeing you up to regurgitate some thoughts you already had, but regurgitate some thoughts you already had on the Diamondbacks. How do we feel about this?
I wrote a story at the end of the NLCS that I think stands. It follows an essay I wrote before the season about the Diamondbacks. I think the players were a little, I went to the Diamondbacks clubhouse after the loss last night, and they were a little hesitant to buy into this narrative because I think especially, Evan Longoria, who played in a World Series in 2008 and then didn't play in another one until this year, is especially hyper aware of how fragile teams are, how flighty the idea of even being a 100 win team over and over and over again does not guarantee you the chance of getting back to here. So I don't want to frame this in a, oh, they're coming back way, but this feels like the beginning for the Diamondbacks. You know, I think you saw, especially with Zach Gallen struggling for most of the postseason and then really putting it together at the end, even though he took the loss, you know, that was a huge performance with their backs against the walls. And it felt like they were in the prelude to something. This was not the best regular season team. They were up and down. They didn't have the depth that a lot of teams that we see get to the World Series have, but it is pretty realistic to think they will build that. Corbin Carroll is not going anywhere. He's signed for roughly forever. He's the best player on this team. He's one of the top 10 players in the sport. They have a very solid base to start with there. And so I think you can look at the Diamondbacks, and aside from the disappointment of getting so close and kind of falling short in the World Series, you can say this is a team that if they make a few correct moves is suddenly a contender, not in the, like, going to beat the Dodgers for the division every year way. You don't have to do that to be a contender, as we have proven over and over again. But in the make it to October and be dangerous way, I would not be surprised if the Diamondbacks are in the playoffs multiple times in the next 5 years with something approaching this core. We can talk on a later episode about what they might do in the winter, because I think they're actually one of the more interesting teams this offseason. But yeah, I view it as a beginning for the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, we should say, if we had like a third person, we would have done something on Zach Gallen. I have not yet today gone and read any Diamondbacks stories off of last night's game, but I would love to know what happened, because seemingly the big reason he was struggling, because Zach Gallen is a very good pitcher, is that he had thrown so many innings and he's like your size. And that,
yes,
no offense to you, I don't think you could throw that many innings.
I cannot.
And so presumably he was a little fatigued. I mean, everyone is fatigued. They really made a mistake putting the World Series at the end of the baseball season when everyone is at their most tired. But I don't know how he then had such a phenomenal game. Like, I would love to have talked to him. I saw him when I was walking down the hall and I didn't stop, but I wanted to, and be like, hey, that was incredible. What happened? Really poetically sad that he took the loss. Like, he was the losing pitcher in addition to the team losing, because this was far and away the best start of his postseason, if not his whole career. It was truly an incredible performance. And Corbin Carroll was like, did not have the same kind of like, look, there's like hope here in that last game, but he had a good postseason.
He did his in NLCS game 7.
Yes.
He took over that game, and everyone, I think, will remember that.
It's true, though, that teams who are young and come close, and actually, even if they're not young, if they come close, they always say like, oh, well, we'll be back. And they're not back that much. Like everyone's going to hate this podcast for taking the day after the World Series to talk about the Houston Astros, who got eliminated in the ALCS. But like, when the Houston Astros got eliminated, and I was thinking about whether or not, like, as that game was winding down and the Rangers were going to win and the Astros were going to lose, I was thinking, like, should I write about the Astros? Because generally, before I get to the World Series, I end up writing a lot about the team that got eliminated because they're done. That's the end of their season. Now we know how that goes. And the Astros in particular, the reigning champions. So when they get eliminated, you're like, oh, okay, well, that's what happened with the reigning champions this year. And so I thought about whether or not I should like write about them getting eliminated in game 7 of the CS, and landed on, like, honestly, that's still so impressive given how consistently good in the postseason they've been that it doesn't really merit. Like, if they'd been eliminated in the first round, it would have merited writing about more in some ways, because it's like, it's actually really hard to be back. And it's, I hope that the D-backs are back, because they, you know, because they're good and they play. I did grow to love all of the bunts, honestly. I think I'm the only person who liked the bunts more the more I saw them. So I would not be unhappy for them to be back. But man, I just keep thinking about like when the Mariners got eliminated last year and they were all like, it's okay, we're going to be back. And it did seem like it. And then they were not even in the postseason. So there's no moral to that story other than like, it's probably going to be the Dodgers and the Astros next year if you had to, or the Braves. It's going to be, if you had to bet now on who's going to be in the World Series, you'd probably have to be like, I don't know, Braves, Astros, I guess. Like, it's tough to break through. And even if you are a team that is thinking you're at the right point in your window, your cycle, rebuild, whatever, like, it gets derailed really quickly. Look at the Orioles. Like, you can go from being like, yeah, like the Orioles thought last year, like, next year's our year, and then this year was their year, and then they got, like, it's like, it can be undone really, really quickly, which is maybe a reason to appreciate that this postseason featured the World Series featured the Rangers and the D-backs. I think a lot of people were like, really? Rangers, D-backs? And it's like, honestly, it's tough. It's tough for two somewhat surprising teams to emerge from each side of the bracket. That is, for as much as we think that the postseason is too much of a crapshoot, for both teams to be wildcard teams, to be teams that lost 100-plus games 2 years ago, to be teams that weren't in the postseason at all last year, like, that is a, not to quote Rob Manfred, a feature, not a bug of baseball that happens at all, because it doesn't actually happen as much as we fear. So often we just get the Astros or the okay, so now we should talk about the Rangers, what they do well, what they're good at, will they be back? Their almost entire team is going to be back, so they probably will be, not to contradict myself. I was talking to a Rangers front office person before the game who, as it turns out, has very similar brain to me, because he was like, I just worry that as soon as it's done, I'm going to start thinking about what I need to do for next year. And I was like, don't do that. and then I saw him and I was like, are you thinking about, after they won in the celebration, I was like, are you thinking about next year? And he's like, yes. Like, Brock Burke, are we tendering him? What's happening? But they actually have very few things to think about, because they signed Marcus Semien and Corey Seager for a very long time, and they're still at the beginning of those contracts. And then a lot of the other guys are really young. Like, the whole idea that they bought this championship, this is what I wrote about yesterday. The whole idea that they bought the championship is not to like drink their Kool-Aid, but one of the things that general manager Chris Young likes to say a lot, he said this exact thing multiple times, is like, I didn't want Josh Young to have to bat third in a rebuild, which is kind of like the anti-Orioles take in a way. His point, Josh Young is their rookie all-star third baseman. And his point was kind of like, even if you have good players in your system, it's not going to hurt them to have proven veterans around them in the clubhouse, ahead of them in the lineup, taking a lot of pressure off them in the headlines and to the fan base. Like, I was thinking about this a lot yesterday as the Rangers run was coming to an end. This idea that, like, by having the narrative be about spending all of the money, you're kind of protecting your players from having to deliver on losing. Like, I was thinking about it a lot in juxtaposition to the Orioles and this idea that, like, the Orioles brass, to their credit, I suppose, very successfully sold their fan base on the idea that, like, we had to be bad so that way we could get all these draft picks and have this young homegrown team and, like, that's going to make it worth it and all that. And this is not to say that I've seen Orioles fans be mean to Adley Rutschman or whatever, but that's a lot of pressure on Adley Rutschman to be like, this is why we were bad, because this guy is going to, like, and he has been incredible, but, like, he did not lead them to a championship. And
Yet.
No, I know. But I just mean, like, the Rangers did it by spending $500 million kind of narrative. It puts some pressure on Marcus Semien and Corey Seager, admittedly. But it I think, takes a lot of pressure off guys like Evan Carter, Jonah Heim, Adolis Garcia, even, to sort of have to be like, this is why we lost. Because it feels... Which is interesting, because it's like they also lost a lot and thus had high draft picks, and that's how they got guys like Josh Young. But it's not the same kind of like, eat your vegetables, now you get a little Josh Young. You get to just like, it's nice to your fan base to supplement the high draft picks that you get from losing with spending in free agency to either just put you over the top when you have to face the Orioles, or speed up your contention window so you're not the 2022 Orioles, or just so you have a guy who could win World Series MVP in Corey Seager, even though plenty of other dudes had pretty good postseasons.
Not to cape for the Orioles, but I do feel compelled to say that the Rangers and Orioles had the exact same gap between postseason runs. So
no, that's my point, is that like, but they were obviously bad, and they did get high draft picks from being bad, because that's like a side effect of being bad, not like a thing you have to necessarily strategize. Yeah. But that the narrative around them does now feel, well, first of all, they have a shorter gap between winning World Series because they just did that. But the narrative around them, I think that the money narrative in some ways, while oversimplified, is actually like, I'm like, great, that's a good oversimplified narrative. As opposed to like, losing begets winning is a bad oversimplified narrative, then like, sometimes you have to go out and get good players if you want your team to be good, even if you also have like, good scouting and developing, even if it's not the best scouting and developing. I understand that the Orioles did do an incredible job on all of that. Sorry, this is like not an anti-Orioles podcast. I just think that they're a very useful foil in that their whole thing has been like, we will just wait for the core to be good enough. And it probably will be at some point, because they are, in fact, a very good team at drafting and developing and whatever. But it takes longer. It just takes longer.
Right. I mean, I think this is a case where after every World Series, we always see people rush to identify the thing that everyone should copy about the team that just won. And in this case, we like it because the thing is spend all the money, bring in the exciting free agents, trade for the exciting players at the trade deadline, voila. And, you know, I think we already talked about the payroll confusion, and people will find ways to kind of counter that. I think the other thing to note is they didn't want to put the pressure on Josh Young to hit third, but Evan Carter hit third for the whole postseason, and he had like 30 games under his belt.
But they were very big on like, he hit ninth for like weeks without making like an out. That's an exaggeration. And every day people were like, are you going to move him up in the lineup?
And then they were like, yes.
They were like, okay, fine, we will. But yes, that is, I mean, yeah, they're guys who aren't making hundred millions of dollars also came
through. It's a good combination. It is the Jason Wirth approach that the Nationals took back in the day, which, you know, people can say that didn't work because they didn't actually win a World Series, but with, you know, that particular era of team. But Jason Wirth signing, you know, that is the model that the Rangers took. They said, we're going to bring in big names and that will bring us credibility. That will bring us a willingness for more guys to join up, which, based on talking to some of the pitchers who were key additions this year, like Nathan Eovaldi, that's exactly what happened. They saw the commitment there and they said, we will go be a part of that. And, you know, that did help them. I think assessing any long-term viability of the Rangers because of that is probably too early. I think, you know, if you want to talk about what's going to make the Rangers good or less good in 2025, 2026, it's still the same thing that's going to make everyone else good or bad. And I wouldn't bet on the Rangers over the Orioles in 2026. But that's okay, because they got theirs. They won their World Series. And that's ultimately the point. It's not about right now whether they're going to be good in 2025 or 2026. It is, they built the critical mass that worked right now. And I don't think you have to, you know, unfortunately, I don't think there is an overarching lesson other than
Bruce Bochy can't lose in the postseason. Is that the overarching message?
Maybe. Corey Seager is incredible. If you can get Corey Seager, do that. But yes. I don't think anyone else is going to do that.
Well, I do think, and they tell the same story a lot, and especially as they're sort of moving through the postseason. I joke about this at the beginning of every postseason, is that, like, if you don't feel like you know a team at the beginning of the postseason, oh my God, you will be tired of whatever their story is by the time they get to game five of the World Series. Like, you'll be like, okay, so you mean to tell me that in a span of 48 hours after they lost 102 games, they spent $500 million on two shortstops. But that origin story is a good one, and not just because it involves money, but because, right, you mentioned the pitchers all talking about how, like, they, part of why they wanted to come here was because Corey and Marcus had come, and that gave the organization credibility. I really do think, like, so this is a little bit what I wrote about last night, was, like, I was writing about the idea that, like, at some point we talked on the podcast about how spending money and building through free agency is seen as, like, less narratively satisfying or, like, less fan servicey almost, even though it involves spending money on good players, because guys, like, because it feels like a, like, you're just like a, it's just like a bunch of mercenaries assembled to do the thing that they're all trying to do anyway. So I wrote last night a little bit about the idea that, like, the spending moneyness of the Rangers is not incompatible with seeing it as, like, a human story or, like, a personality story. And that origin of them signing Marcus and Corey after the 2021 season, like, that involves Chris Young, who was still under John Daniels at the time, but is, I think, credited with, like, making the pitch to those guys, really selling them both on a vision that was hard to see. And not just his success in selling them on it, but their willingness to take that leap and to take it together, kind of, and to be the people who were willing to take on all the pressure that I was talking about before, that they would absorb and place in lieu of their younger teammates, but also, right, like, sign at a team that was going to lose 94 games again the next year so that pitchers would see that credibility, whatever, whatever. Like, I find that part of the Rangers' success story, even if it's not replicable, even if it's just purely how'd they do this, what's the narrative, put a nice, like, story to it, that is a nice story. That is that, like, these two guys who were veterans, who were proving Corey had won a World Series, Marcus had not, but, and they had these, like, very serious, stoic, business-like personalities, but that they did, like, a interesting thing. I think a lot about, like, how many different ways, okay, I'm trying not to make this analogy take too long because immediately my brain is going to Freddie Freeman and how everybody was like, we wanted him to stay with the Braves. And I was like, that would have been a great narrative as well, because I do love a one-team player. But also a pretty cool narrative is, like, he's crying on the field because he didn't get to stay with the Braves, but now he's, like, on a as good team and is as good, if not better than the as almost as good, but not quite better guy that got whatever. Like, I was just like, that's like a cool way for that to go. That's a, how many plot lines can we fit into one baseball? And I like the Corey Seager, Marcus Semien plot line in Texas. Like, I like the, like, it's, you're right, it's the Jason Wirth play, but there's two of them, so that's cute because then they get to
and
be friends.
They're a little bit higher on the, you know, Jason right. Wirth was not an MVP level player, and these guys are at least contenders.
Right. Like, they will forever be heroes in Texas, and not just because they, like, hit a key home run or something. They have a deep-rooted narrative hero, like, tie to that city, which I just think is cool. Well, and they're going to probably be there for the rest of their careers because they're in their 30s now.
Yes. I mean, Marcus Semien seems like he's made of, like, some material from outer space that never breaks down. So maybe he will be around forever. But he did set, I believe, the record for most plate appearances taken in a season, which is impressive. And in his last one, he homered. So, you know, he was doing fine. I will say there's this thing that has happened over and over again with Corey Seager. People have been asking him about this and, like, trying to find different ways to make it interesting and, like, momentous. And I'm sorry, I don't find this interesting at all. So I'm going to make fun of it. People wrote and reported that he found it intriguing or a selling point that the Rangers had never won the World Series when he decided to sign there. That was reported back when he signed. It was brought up again in post-game press conferences. And Corey Seager, this man does not think about anything except hitting baseballs. He did not, like, play this up. It was not his fault that this became a thing.
No, but it is his fault that there's nothing else to play up about.
And in the press conferences last night, someone asked him, like, you know, they were trying to pin down, like, a timeline. It was like, when did you, like, did you know before you started talking to them? He was like, no, I mean, I really didn't know that they never won the World Series. I found out between when he talked to, like, basically Chris Young told him that.
Right.
And then he was like, so I knew between when I started talking to them and when I signed. It's like, we don't need, like, he did not need to know this to sign with the Rangers. Let's stop playing it up.
All right, would you like us to play up about Corey Seager, a man who gives nothing?
I mean, you got to just play up that he's good at baseball. And that's sort of the... We don't need to make it a, you know, he did not ride into Texas to save the Rangers because he was sad that this poor franchise had never won the World Series. He rode into Texas because they gave him $325 million.
Yes.
And that's fine. That's a good move. He is worth it.
Yes.
But that's it.
Fine. I have nothing else to say about Corey Seager because he is so boring. So you've undermined the one thing that people found that is interesting about him. Bruce Bochy won again. He now has 4 World Series titles. You and I were talking about this before the game, and I was kind of joking about it. Like, the tricky thing about writing about Bruce Bochy when a team wins a World Series is that you've been writing about the possibility that the team would win the World Series since they signed Bruce Bochy, because that's, like, kind of the thing. He signed in October last year, I realized. He wasn't... I was trying to place it in my head because I knew he was at the winter meetings as the Giants manager, but he signed in October.
Rangers manager.
What did I just say?
Giants manager.
Giants manager.
he transported himself.
he was introduced. He was the Rangers manager at the winter meetings last year, which were in early December, but he joined the team in October. So it's been just about a year. And I was like, yeah, that's right. It's like, you can't sneak up on anybody in the World Series when you have Bruce Bochy managing, because as soon as Bruce Bochy comes on, they're like, oh my God, are they going to win the World Series? Is that the thing? Is that where they're going? That'd be cool. Wouldn't that be funny? No way that happens, right? He's not magic. but then they did. And I was like the whole way through, it's like in like June, if you like read a Bruce Bochy story, it probably was like, and if he wins a World Series this year, so then on the eve of him or the cusp of him winning a World Series, it felt kind of tough to come up with something new to say, because it was like they got their guy.
He's doing the thing.
He's doing the thing that they thought he was going to do when they signed him. Which I keep saying hired.
Yeah, we should talk about the one other Bruce Bochy plot line that seems to be a thing in every postseason run, which is. He loves
his one
guy.
He only likes two pitchers?
He likes one guy.
Okay. Yeah. I gave him two.
He loves to ride a reliever all the way through. And this year, that reliever was Jose Leclerc, who pitched, I believe he was one outing short of tying the all-time record for appearances in a postseason.
And yet they didn't bring him in.
In the last game, they had Josh Spores pitch the final two. I think he ended up pitching the final inning and two thirds. Whatever.
And he was great.
He was terrific, but it was like if Bruce Bochy had placed a bet against his own tendencies, I mean, he would have won $1 million off of this not bringing in Leclerc for the last inning.
Not that we should, like, however many minutes into this podcast, be recapping specific games, but, like, the decision to bring Leclerc in the ninth inning with, what, one out, two outs already? Of game four.
Yeah.
When they were up by like a bunch of runs, and then he did give up one, but it didn't matter. And I feel like anybody else could have done that. It was such a weird decision that at that point I was like, well, he's just behaving emotionally. He's just going to bring in Jose Leclerc to close out every single game. That's cool, I guess. Maybe he knows about the record and he's going for it. And then to not bring him in game five when they had a 5-0 lead and there was no one on base, I don't think. Like,
no.
You could have, I was like, I don't think he's not going to give up a grand slam and then some with no one on base. Just bring him in with like two outs or whatever. I hope that Jose Leclerc was like, I'm tired. I hope he specifically asked to not pitch. Or they just thought no one's talking about Josh Boers and he deserves more credit because he was equally phenomenal. There were all postseason people were like, Bruce Bochy's inner circle. It's Jose Leclerc, it's Josh Boers, and it's Aroldis Chapman. And I was like, yeah, I got some issues with that last one. Why did we keep bringing in Aroldis Chapman, who has never had a clean inning for as long as I can remember? And frankly, all I know about him is that he gives up big home runs in the postseason. He got through the inning last night, but he did give up some base runners first. Okay. Anything else on Bruce Bochy?
I think the thing you have to be curious about now is like, oh, okay, how long does he want to do this? I mean, he already retired and came out of retirement once. I think it's interesting. There have been a couple, not to get into off-season managerial stuff, but I will note that there have been a couple Rangers staffers who have declined to interview elsewhere for managerial or other sorts of executive jobs, which I don't know. I find it interesting. I think they've got some people who are very happy to work there and maybe wait it out and see if they can be the next manager of this team. I don't think Bruce Bochy's retiring this offseason or anything. I think it's an interesting situation when you've got a guy who's very clearly in his legacy stage as to how they maintain consistency.
I mean this with no judgment in any particular direction, but last year when Dusty Baker won, he's since retired. But last year when Dusty Baker won, I was like, do you think he'll retire? I don't remember who I was talking to. And they were like, no. And that's a more fraud answer as it pertains to Dusty Baker. But they were like, you got to take the victory lap once you win the World Series. You don't want to not be there when you're the reigning champions. And I don't know if that's why Dusty Baker didn't retire last year, but he did retire this year. If I'm Bruce Bochy, I'm at least doing the victory lap.
Yeah, got to do a victory lap.
You got to do a victory lap. And he's not retiring. Sorry, that makes it sound like we think there's speculation that he's retiring after like 1 year. He's not. Which is good because he's a true delight to cover. This was an all-star World Series of managers. These managers were just... And this is not like a commentary on their managerial abilities, although they do seem quite good at that. This was a commentary on their press conferences, which were just every day a total delight. Torey Lovello and Bruce Bochy in extremely different ways. Also, they could not compliment each other enough. Literally, it was
big
like
fans of each other.
Because they would be in the press conference room, you know, separately, but like an hour apart. And Torey Lovello would be out here being like, I can't even believe that Bruce Bochy knows my name. And then Bruce Bochy would come in and he would be like, I just think he's the next generation of men. And I was like, wow, these guys, we should get him in the room together. I would love to see that. they were good characters. This was a fun one, if not a memorable one. It's not a memorable one, let's be honest.
I mean, I will remember it. They're all memorable to us baseball writers, but...
Yeah. You say
and
that.
They will be memorable. I guess you did ask what happened in game one earlier.
You say that, but I don't remember like how 2021 ended. Do you? Probably Tyler Matzik. I don't know.
I don't think Matzik was on the mound to end the series, but he was involved.
Did you have fun? This was your first World Series that you covered in person. Your first postseason. We talked about that earlier, but now it's the end.
Now it's the end. It was fun. It's tiring, but I think especially the games in Philadelphia, in the NLCS, the walk-off in game one of this World Series were, that's an environment you don't usually get at a baseball stadium. And it was fun to be in the champagne celebrations. My shoes may need to go in the trash, but that is okay. They have been sacrificed for the good of postseason baseball and stepping in beer.
If you saw me at any point this past month, you probably don't believe this, but I love the postseason. I really love covering it. I think maybe this is why I get so up in arms when people are like, oh, it's not real baseball because it doesn't reflect the 162 games. Because I think that 162 games, you can't keep them all in your head and they're not that important. And that kind of diminishes personally the experience of covering them. I've never been a beat writer. Like, I kind of like that if you like baseball, if you enjoy being at a baseball game, if you find talking about what's like literally happening in front of you on a field to be interesting, then like covering a postseason game is such a concentrated version of that. Like it's such a, this was my fourth time covering games in person because I missed the 2020 season in person. And no other time do I care who they bring out of the bullpen. You know what I mean? Like I'm just like, whatever, maybe the other guy's got a tight hammy today. Like it's just like a, it's, baseball has so many, every baseball game contains so many interesting decisions and backstories and factors and pivot points. And like, and personally, I think more than any other sport, like it's like, I think if a guy like, I don't know, trips while running down the court in basketball, you're probably not like, well, that was it. That was the game right there. But that can happen in baseball. Like if a guy stumbles coming around third and then gets thrown at home plate or whatever, like there's so many moments that are impactful, and on the scale of 6 months, you just actually can't get that worked up about them and that invested in what was behind them. And I kind of like that about covering postseason games. I like the what you're watching feels as important to the sport landscape as a whole as it did in the moment. And that's what it is about the experience. It's really nice. It's like when you're in a postseason game and someone hits like a walk-off home run and the crowd like loses its mind, you're like, oh yeah, that is big to these people. That is big to this moment. And that is big in the scheme of the sport. Like perhaps, like, I mean, we've referenced the David Freese home run and perhaps nothing will be bigger than those. But like, yeah, I bet when that happened, everybody was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And years later, we're still like, so that was a pretty big deal. doesn't happen as much in the regular season. I like that about the postseason. All right, we didn't talk at all about like the offseason, but that seems fine. We didn't.
We have many months for that. Well, a couple months for that.
We have a couple months. We don't have many months.
Yeah, not many months.
As a baseball writer, how often do people say to you, like, what do you do in the offseason? And you're like, baseball? It goes, yeah. It's a lot of baseball, honestly. The GM meetings are next week, and then it's like Thanksgiving, and then it's the winter meetings, and then some point Shohei Ohtani will sign, and we will talk about it on the bandwagon.
I will say, people think we're like teachers where we like get the summer off, and it's like, woo! And it's like, no, I take like a couple weeks to chill between now and December, and then it's you know, back.
Someone's gonna sign, like Craig Counsell is gonna be spotted at like a Hungry Ghost in Park Slope. That's a coffee shop local to us, and we're gonna have to write about it. All right, that's all we've got for you this baseball season. Thank you, Zach. Thank you, producer John, thank you, producer Brett, who's here today because John's not. I don't know when we're going to record again, but like we were just complaining about, they still do baseball things in the winter. So we'll still do baseball things in the winter. And yeah, you can hear it here on the bandwagon.